honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, taking our time this weekend to remember the thousands who died on the Bataan Death March, which began April 9th, 1942. Not to mention all those who survived the march but died in the harsh prisoner of war conditions that followed. And, of course, those who made it through the rest of the war so they could share their stories with us. The orchestrators of the march would later be tried for war crimes and executed. None of this is easy to talk about, and often the details are almost impossible to fathom, as we're going to hear in the memories of 194th Tank Battalion veteran Ero Ben Sacconi.
At first, when I come home, I had nothing else to talk about. It was a prison camp, you know, going 5 years. And then after a while, people started looking at me kind of funny. And my brother said, I wasn't talking much anymore. I said, well, everybody looks at me though I'm lying or something, and I just didn't care about talking about it. But a lot of days I don't remember what happened on the march, and they say I was a survivor. And one of the longest, too, by the way, where I was caught. You see, that's why what you read in history, they say 55, 60 miles. Well, I went over 100 miles, and it took me 13 days because on the wrong side of the island. I had my platoon. We were supposed to counterattack and then cut across and get on the easy road back. But I started back. Japanese had artillery set up there, so I had no choice but to back up. When I got there, they started the march. I was running the tail end. That's why it was 13 days. It was most of them 5, 7, 8 days. If I could have crossed the island, then I'd have been a lot better. And along the march, I don't know how many days we were on it, but he got us all out. He put us out in the field. Well, in comes a sharp. He graduates from the University of California, or Southern California. Born and raised here. He called us every dirty, rotten name he could, some I didn't even know about. Made us take our hats off and sit out in that sun with no water and nothing for about 8, 9 hours. And he called us every dirty name. Well, we lost 10,000 men on the march and dead all over the place. But as far as food, we had a rice ball along the way. But you're talking about 2 weeks. I had another buddy, and we couldn't go any further, so we fell out. But lucky, I don't know how long I was there, 2 or 3 days. And finally, some guy striking telephone wire, and he hit us, and of course, you had to get the hell out and back in the highway again. So we had to go. We got in the highway, waiting for the stragglers, and couldn't find out. It was only a couple of miles where we ended up, but there was about 50. And when we got in this place with a number of maggots and dead people, next morning, there was only 8 alive, and the rest were just dead. The last stop, we took a break. We were just dead tired. We were off the road, and there was a Filipino. I gave him a little water, but he died. So we flopped down, and then they said the Jap guards were covered up. So we just stayed there and played dead. Thank God the guy next to me was dead. They just hit us with a rifle and just kept on going.
What happened after that?
We finally got up and joined the trek again. You had to get out on the road. If they caught you, they would kill you.
And thousands upon thousands died, whether that way or otherwise. In fact, an accurate estimate of just how many died is still elusive because of the way it all unfolded. But you're facing the prospect of dying from starvation or from exhaustion, by cruelty at the hand of your captors, and in all likelihood, you're never going to see your wife and kids again.
My wife waited 3 years before she even knew I was alive. My wife had to go to work. And I had 2 children and a grandmother living with her. So my wife, lucky she's a college graduate, she got a job, and then she worked in theater at nights, and then she done some waitress work on Saturday night. She went to the Army. You know, I haven't got any money. My husband's as a prisoner of war. You know, oh, no, he's missing an accident. Well, we got to have something from your husband. You know, what a silly thing to tell my wife. So she had to go home with nobody giving nothing. Took her 8 months before she got a dime. The Japanese put out a propaganda that I was being held. Then she heard the official word was just a month before I was liberated. I wasn't liberated, I liberated myself.
And we want to hear about the liberation, but before we get to that, I understand you were 174 pounds when you got to the Philippines, that on the march you got down to about half of that. But one of the things that helped you gain back a little bit of that weight after the march is that you actually befriended some of your captors?
I made friends. As a matter of fact, my life was saved Why, this Nagano-san up there, I went to Japan to see him. And if it wasn't for him, like I tell you, on May, took most of my men I could find. It took us 3 hours to walk about 100 yards to get on this truck. If you get on the truck, you'd go into detail. And they took about 300 of us. Then the next day we went on, they stopped the convoy. 150 went on ahead, and 150 others stayed in this little town of Kalawan. And lucky, there's where we had a Japanese captain, professor at the University of Tokyo, spoke English. And he gives a talk that told us we fought a good war, we had to obey his laws, and there was no other way. And he would take care of us, or feed us, till we could go to war. He called in doctors, had the Filipinos bring us meat and food. We didn't have to do any for 2 weeks if it wasn't for him. And then I got the job working in the kitchen, and this Nagano-san, the one up there, took a liking to me. He took care of me like I was a baby, I guess. Made give me sugar, smokes, and everything. So for 2 weeks, we didn't do anything. And if it wasn't for that, we'd all die.
So now,
let me tell you the rest. The 150 that went above us, only 8 survived that. We were lucky, that whole group, that 150 of us. We lost 7, and they would have died anyway. They were too sick to start with. But if it wasn't for them, and like I say, that Nagano-san, he helped save all our lives there, not only me. Then the story goes on for years.
Yeah, and you actually went and found him in Japan 8 years after the war and thanked him?
When I found out he was alive, we went to Tokyo. And I were at the Imperial Hotel. When I got downstairs, right in the early part of the evening, I spotted him with the stuff in his hands. He spotted me, put our arms around each other, right? In Japan, now, that's something else.
The late Ben Sacconi. I'll never forget him telling me that he planned to burn the diaries he had kept from some of his fellow Bataan Death March survivors because some of the contents were so severe and so extreme, they shouldn't be seen by anyone. We're up to 4 American servicemen whose memories of the march we've heard today, but there were far more Filipinos involved, and far more Filipinos who died as a result of the march. Adelano David was one of thousands of Filipinos to sign up for American military service before the war.
We were grossly underprepared. Our rifles were too large for the Filipino. To sight the barrel, we had to put the heavy stock on our shoulders, and every time we fired, it bruised our shoulders. And most of the time, because the equipment came from World War I, some of them probably were not properly cleaned or they were just obsolete. They exploded in our faces and we had casualties. So the first engagement against the Japanese was a fiasco because we had exploding bombs, rifles. Our machine gun and mortar shells didn't explode. They were duds. So against a veteran army and really from Nanking and from Manchuria, and most of our men were farmers and clerks. And some of us didn't even know how to handle a rifle. So we had to retreat from the beach defense to Agno River on North Luzon while we didn't have any more air cover. We lost 350 scouts on the first engagement in Agno River out of 800 because they, on horseback, they fought against tanks.
And these are the stories so many people are unaware of, and I'm so thankful we have you to clue us in a little bit. Were there rumblings of the surrender before it happened, before General King said, yep, this is it?
No, it was a total surprise. Well, most of us cried because we didn't want to surrender. And then when the order came to surrender, a lot of us were still fighting. In spite of the order to surrender, they were bombing us anyway. We were on the last defense on Mount Samat. We lost practically all of our 33rd Infantry was wiped out on Samat. And when I came to me to surrender, I had a choice of going into the mountains because there was a rumor that we could go instead of surrendering. But we couldn't because if we surrendered, anybody who surrendered was shot anyway. They had orders to kill all prisoners. As a matter of fact, there's a record in the books which says The first surrenderers were about 300 mixed U.S. Army and Philippine Army. They were massacred, 300 of them, and they had surrendered.
I can't imagine what that feels like to be in a situation where you have to make that decision. And you had family to worry about too, right?
Yes, I had a girlfriend who was waiting, and I didn't know where she was. She didn't know where I was. My father didn't even know I was in the army because I didn't tell him.
What do you think led you to decide what you decided, and how scary and frightening was that?
We decided to surrender because if we went to the mountains, we were blocked anyway, and we could be captured anyway. But when we surrendered, a lot of us went away to the hills, including Colonel Topley, who became the guerrilla leader in Zambales Mountains. When I escaped from the death march, that's what I joined. When we first surrendered, we were lined up. Anybody found with Japanese money, paper money, or anything, or a sword, or as a souvenir, or anything that has a Japanese marking, the owner, the soldier who had it, was usually beheaded or beaten up. On my own, they tried to take my watch and my military ring, and I objected. And when I objected, the soldier hit me with the butt of his rifle in the belly and on my shins. So I fell down on my knees, and I was so angry I was going to retaliate when I got up. But a buddy mine held me back. He said, "Don't howl, it's going to kill you," because they've done that. And when we gathered together in groups of 100, sometimes groups of 50, to start us on the march. On the march, even before I got too far from the site of surrender, I saw already bodies on the road, bayoneted. And these are not soldiers who were fighting, but they were sick, too sick to go on, with malaria, dysentery. That's when I began to lose hope. I said, "Oh, I'm going to die." Then in the next town, if I have a chance, I'll die trying to escape or escape. And I did that.
So how far into the march was that? How many days?
One day. So when I escaped, at first what my buddies were trying to do was, because I could not stand up anymore, and they could not carry me anymore. I had malaria and dysentery and a shrapnel wound, and I was fainting. So he said, "The next chance we have, you better go." When we saw the Japanese away from the guarding us, I tried to escape through the bushes, but they suddenly jerked me back, and they said, "I'll wait for another chance." At this point, I decided to die marching because I was scared for some reason or other. Now I got scared. When they saw a gap a few miles afterwards, they pushed me through the bushes, and I fell across the bushes into a trench dug out by the Filipino occupants of the house by the road. And they covered me with banana leaves and bamboo leaves.
So you get pushed by your friends, who've already saved your life a couple times, it sounds like, by holding you back from retaliating and then telling you not to escape then. They push you into the bushes, you fall into this trench, and you're so weak you don't even know what to do, but these occupants of the house come down and cover you?
I was out for a while because I was sick and thirsty and starving. When I woke up, I was already in the house, and they nursed me for 3 days. On the fourth day, I told them that I had to go, and they pointed me. They gave me a map where to join the rest of the group. Apparently, they had help other people. Many soldiers escaped through the same, so they knew where to go.
And, you know, there are so many great stories about the war in Europe, and we hear about, you know, the Corrie Ten Booms of the world and the Anne Frank situation, or Oskar Schindler, and these people that protected some of the Jews. And we don't hear so many stories about the Pacific, but really these people risked their lives to save yours. How did that make you feel? How indebted did you feel to those folks?
Lifetime. But when I came back, I was back into the MacArthur Liberation Army. I looked for them, but they had moved away already. I know their last names, De La Cruz, but up to now I've not been able to contact them.
And it sounds like you've spent some time trying.
This is the same time I was looking for my sweetheart, and because they had gone to the hills and I didn't know where. So it took me a while to finally give up. So when I finally found where she was home in Manila.
And a lot happened in between there. Is there any question in your mind that if you hadn't escaped at that point, that you would have survived or not? What do you think would have happened?
I would have died on the way, because on the way there were cattle cars where we were going to be confined. It was a cow car where only 100 could be, and they were jam-packed. They could not even sit down. I would have, I probably would have died of starvation and thirst on the way, or malaria or dysentery, because it was from where I escaped, it was another 30 miles. I would like to remember the young people my age who died unnecessarily, because if Japan listened to the peace treaties and the wishes of the Japanese people, a million Filipinos should not have died. So I would like to remember it as a episode in the Philippine history which should not have happened. It's important for me because I lost a lot of friends my age. I also lost a brother-in-law who was killed by the Japanese brutally. And a lot of people suffering during the Japanese occupation. People who were happy, peace-loving people. Suddenly they were in the middle of brutality and killings that were not necessary.
It's been 81 years, but the stories of what happened on the Bataan Death March will echo forever. An absolutely tragic death for thousands, but also an inspiring story of perseverance and survival for the five men whose memories we tried to digest today. Men who committed the rest of their time on Earth to honoring those who did not have the privilege of making it home. As we've heard so often over the years, we must never forget. Thanks for taking the time to ponder a very difficult topic today. Stories like these provide perhaps the most powerful reminders of those four words we conclude with each week on Hometown Heroes. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.